Welcome to The You Catastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison, joined as always by my co-host here, Dave Taylor, who just right now was telling me that the New Zealand accent is quite masculine.
So. I was saying that there was a type of New Zealand accent quite masculine.
No take backs. And he was saying that sometimes he just plays us recordings in order to go to sleep because I...
Did you know someone new started at my work recently and his name's Dave as well, and they decided to call him Manly Dave and me Dave.
fair enough. Accents. I always think about this because we were going to the beach on Sunday. Yes, I said beach. And our two-year-old Ambrose started saying about how he's going to have fish and chips. And it just really kind of breaks my heart every time. What can I do? Like, I don't know, some sort of indoctrination program, send him off to, I don't know, the east coast of New Zealand for 6 months when he's 4 years old, survivalist program.
Yeah, I guess you could do that. Or, you know... As his godfather, I'd like some sort of say into his spiritual well-being.
You can go with him. Catechize him.
Catechize him.
In the wilderness.
Yeah. So these are called jandals.
That's right.
This is a...
Well done.
What is it? A chili bin?
A chili bin. Why is that a weird thing? What do you guys call
hilarious.
It? A schooner. Is it a schooner? No. What do you call it?
That's a beer. Yeah, it's an Esky.
Oh, Esky. Isn't that the brand name?
Yeah. Like terrible. Hoovering.
Yeah, that's called a vacuum cleaner, actually. Yeah. Anyway, this isn't what we're talking about today. We're actually continuing our...
There's racial division.
It's heating up, folks. It's heating up. Ooh, it's Rugby World Cup time, Dave. Did you know that?
All I know is Australia got beaten by Wales.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, it was hilarious. Yeah. I mean, the way that Checker, your coach...
So how's that?
Checker's the worst thing to happen to world rugby. He's... You know what I'm saying?
I just don't know what these words are.
All right. Anyway.
I know the words, but in that order, I just...
Oh, man. You just... It's like existential live or die for my country, eh? So what we're actually doing is talking again about James Davis Hunter's To Change the World, The Irony, Tragedy, and Possibility of Christianity in the Late Modern World, his book here. As part of the occasional episode we like to do about trying to map out and think it through with... some other people about how they're thinking about Christians in contemporary public life and what that looks like. So last week we were talking about Hunter's understanding of cultural change, his challenge to the notion that culture exists simply as a matter of conversion of individuals' hearts and minds through worldview talk especially, and how he understands cultural change to entail much more about networks operating often around centers or the periphery there and exercising forms of symbolic and cultural power. The second component that we wanted to discuss is...
How Kevin Sorbo plays into all this. Sorry, you keep going.
Oh, like God is dead. God is not dead films? Yeah, totally. Yeah. Have you seen any of those?
No, I want to watch one for the podcast.
We should do a Kirk Cameron marathon one day. That'd be awesome.
Maybe when we're finally on Patreon, that can be our special.
Pay us to watch Kirk Cameron films.
Yeah.
All right. So what we're actually looking at today is his second component where he says that paradoxically this focus on individuals has led Christians, and he's talking especially in the American context, but whether it translates is interesting, to emphasize politics, Christians emphasizing politics, lawmakers, judges, policy wonks as a vehicle for Christian witness. And he thinks that this is a problem, this idea that law, he says, becomes the outcome of, according to this cultural view of individualism, is made by individual politicians, judges, and policymakers, and so we must vote in the right people, for example. Now, he has a real, this all-consuming focus on politics he thinks is harmful to Christian witness for reasons I'll go into in a moment. In contrast, he argues in his book for what he calls faithful presence. And this is essentially cultivating persons and communities in various spheres of life who then encourage shalom or peace, flourishing of others and self-sacrificial love towards them in a manner that emulates God's own character. Now, faithful presence, you could say, is something of a kind of muddled middle way. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad sense. It's a constructive tension, he describes, between accommodating to existing social realities and calling them into question. Wherever the person finds him or herself, the heart is about formation, creating a culture or a community that enacts this peace. Now, there's arguably an echo here for those interested in this sort of thing. There's arguably an echo of the neo-Calvinist or Kuyperian notion of sphere sovereignty developed by Abraham Kuyper, former Dutch prime minister and theologian, of a notion of faithfulness in each sphere. So spheres of life, Kuyper had this idea that life can be separated into spheres of education, family, work, and then ultimately a sphere of the state as well. Now he sees this. This is Hunted. Now he sees our building of communities in these different spheres as covenantal in character, focusing on communities that are concerned with truth and beauty and belonging and a sense of fairness. So he says this can take place anywhere. So he talks about it in a corporate setting, for example. He gives us an example, which I think is interesting because it leads to conceptions of law and power that he doesn't necessarily elaborate on, about creating a community of fair work and fair wage, in which there is more of a sense of focus collectively on creativity of the good involved. And he takes that level and then he goes all the way down to simply talking about an individual grocery bagger as one of his examples of someone who just smiled and presented a joyous life to those that they encountered. So at times you can see it sort of almost sounds pretty individualistic, cultivating individual lives and discipleship. And you could even say from our previous discussion, there's almost a focus on trying to get right thinking again, you know, trying to get the right shape of a community and so on, which he was quite critical of in the context, especially of worldview talk. But he does talk about the church as itself as a polis, and he rejects notions of anti-institutionalism. You know, the idea that you get, especially in sort of some emergent context, that being anti-institutional can be revolutionary. Which I think rightly, Hunter says, is just can boil down to a form of consumer choice and modern individualism, yes. Right?
And so it actually ends up, anti-institutionalism ends up affirming our institution, which is atomized individuals
right.
exercising free choice.
Right.
So in that sense, by seeking to distance yourself from institutions, you ally yourself with the current political paradigm.
Right.
Which I think is a trap that a lot of progressive Christians fall into.
And then undermine potentially the institutions that could, as Hunter argues, provide the constructive resistance to what is what you're describing as a contemporary paradigm of things in service to individuals, right? Now, underlying this argument for faithful presence is what I'd call a certain anti-politics in Hunter's thinking that I think is really important. And presents points for critical purchase. So he argues that Christian witness in politics has been diabolically bad. Now, this may be true as a matter of fact, but then it's interesting because he takes this sort of historical component or contemporary scene and he kind of reifies that into the logic of politics as such.
Yep.
So for him, politics is ultimately the coercive power of the state, I think. It entails competition amongst factions, trying to dominate each other and exercise a will to power. And then that leads to people engaging in vilifying, people engaging in acts of violence to coerce people to their ways. So he's critical of neo-Anabaptists like Howarth in his book, but at the same time he essentially agrees with those neo-Anabaptists that Christian witness through politics amounts to the so-called boogeyman of Constantinianism, right?
Okay.
Which is using the state as a site of violence to further Christianity. Now, he thinks this is being really toxic in the Christian context and also then for the culture more generally, because he thinks it's driven in large part by ressentiment, which is resentment mixed with envy and hatred and anger, the sense of alienation from the power that you see both on the right and the left. So the right in the States, he's talking, you know, we'll talk about the need to get back to foundational Christian principles, okay, of the founders and so on. The left will talk about the need to go back to the Old Testament, the Hebrew prophets, right? And then engaging with the Democratic Party, for example, yeah, and so on, because they've been alienated from the halls of Christian power as well as political power. So there's, he thinks that that then cultivates a sense that you are basically acting like you are an interest group.
Right.
And then that weakens your cultural presentation because you're no longer forming culture. You're just simply one constituent party, yep, to be co-opted by political, yep, authority, right? Which political authority he defines in this way as intrinsically about coercion, intrinsically, okay, about, he says, the nitty-gritty, has a sense in which it's about factions and it's about the exercise of power, right? Now, right, there's an interesting question there, whether that, for him, being a sociologist, I think that for him is the logic of civil authority as such.
Okay. So to recap, he's saying that that the church's involvement in state power, because in the past it has been coercive, vilifying, dehumanizing of other parties, that the church wielding what the mechanisms of state can't be the solution in this situation.
I think he goes a little step further. So yes, there is that,
yeah,
that this is how it's actually been operating.
Yeah.
And then these groups have been operating out of resentment, envy, anger, and so on, and a will to power.
When you said which groups are
both operating, left and right. So okay, in his context, he'd be talking about, you know, your factions like Moral Majority when it was in existence, yeah, and so, okay, on in the US, the Christian right,
yeah,
but then also the Christian left, yeah, right, and various figures like Jim Wallis and so, okay, on, who very much operated within Democratic Party tent and so on.
Yeah.
Now, he sees that as historically in a contemporary sense the case.
Yeah.
But he goes further, I think, because he's actually saying that that is the nature, I think he's saying, as a I think this is a sociological term. Right. They're trying to define, like Weber would talk about.
Sociologists tend to
define it by a certain logic, that, yeah, you rarefy it into saying, now this thing has a logic because it operates, okay, in a sphere. So this is why I said it echoes Kuyperian notions of sphere sovereignty, the notion that the state operates with its own internal logic,
okay,
right? So Weber would talk about the monopoly on violence, for, okay, example, as its logic. Or some people, yeah, would talk about the utilitarian calculus of balancing different interests of individuals, yeah, as the very nature of what politics is, yeah, right?
Whereas someone like yourself would see the logic of the church somehow pointing to what the logic of the state ought to be.
Right. So that's why I think is interesting in Hunter's book is it's very thin,
okay,
on political theology.
Right? Yeah.
Very thin on thinking theologically about the nature of law, authority, and, yeah, politics. Instead, it takes that kind of sociological turn. And in essence, then that becomes a liberal state. Because what he defines it as is the exercise of power.
Yeah.
Now, you could go back as early as someone like Jean Gerson in the 14th century, right, who talks about rights as a matter of exercising one's dominion or power,
yeah,
over property, bodies, and persons and oneself. Right? Yeah. And this is kind of then becomes the liberal state in understanding that the negotiation of people asserting power, right?
Right.
And so in that sense, it's kind of like dirty,
yeah,
right? It's kind of like it has its own sort of logic. It's, yeah, rarefied into the thing, but it's something that you could criticize theologically in order to create, in order to think through, well, what does it look like to actually talk about Christian politics? But I don't think Hunter fully does that.
Yes. So he
or what, has the resources.
What seems to be missing is a sense that there are objective ends to politics.
Right.
Or political institutions.
Right.
Apart from the interests of particular instantiations of the church who have different political perspectives or perhaps the broad perspectives of members of the public kind of thing.
Or you could say,
like an Augustinian account, yeah, right, would be that that the state ought to conform to the structures and culture of the heavenly city, right?
Right, right. It's exorted in that direction, yes, right? And it can be used for that ends.
When things are going well, when they are,
right,
conforming
or take
to
it further, you know, like take it further, you know, if you think just you know, through Aristotle into what is politics for, negotiation towards a common good, or you know, even just think about it as a noisy argument about what is the nature of human flourishing together, or Aquinas who would talk about the king's purpose is to cultivate virtue in his subjects. Now, that doesn't mean the king imposes himself in every single way, but it does mean that the king is supposed to encourage, right, virtuous living, including an orientation towards religious ends.
Yeah.
Right. So there are ways of thinking through Christian politics that aren't married to, and this is, I think, the part of the problem, Hunter. He kind of seems to accept that the kind of the grubbiness or the problems we see in the modern bureaucratic liberal state is almost the nature of power in politics itself.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the occupational hazards of sociology, right? You take the descriptive and you make it normative somehow, rather than saying this is the way things ought to be.
Yeah. Now, it has. I think it has implications because before I go there, there's a second element to add. So, yes, I think he adopts this notion of the that he rarefies a notion of what politics is. Now, he has good justification in part, right? Because you look at some of the stuff that goes on, especially in his context in the US, and you think, this is kind of people asserting themselves in a will to dominate and a will to power manner, right? That they're exercising forms of they want to exercise coercive authority and so on, right? But whether that's intrinsic is part of my question.
Yeah, because getting back to stuff I was saying last episode, though, I'm suspicious of how much it is actually political representatives, elected officials, that are exercising that will to power, and whether it's actually the bureaucratic machines, corporate interests, and lobby groups and things like that behind the scenes of the elected officials who are actually where the power actually lies. And that kind of gets back to this point of politics is so much less personal than what I see him describing it as, in the sense that there's less of a capacity for a person to act in that Aristotelian sense, to actually engage in political action as we conceive it, because of things like the need for negotiation, the need to especially in the United States, the need to appease fundraisers and things like that. So
he may actually, to be fair, he may partially agree and see that as a reason for why you don't engage, right? So my difference here.
So when you say we don't engage.
Christians,
so
instead they should engage in this faithful presence. So the difference, and this may be also reflecting a difference between you and I, right? Is that, you know, Alistair McIntyre basically thinks that, you know, operating within the confines of the modern bureaucratic state is impossible. We can't have that as an Aristotelian conception of politics oriented towards a common good,
yes,
because of its bureaucratic and complex nature and so on, right?
Yeah.
And so in ways, Hunter almost echoes this, and he's almost saying that, well, this is a place of compromise and this is a place of nitty-gritty policy that is about balancing individual interests and all these sorts of things. And he discusses how Christians are always disappointed when they engage in this manner because they come up against these various things that demand compromise and so on. Now, I tend to think that that may be partially descriptive of things we see, but it's things we should also be resisting and trying to change, right?
Yeah.
Whereas I think what he's saying is kind of this is, if not intractable, or either intractable or is almost the logic of power itself.
Yeah.
Now, the second...
I don't think it's the logic of... Yeah, so to clarify what I'm saying is I don't think it's about the logic of power as such. I don't think there's anything essential about the nature of either American politics or political structures or Australian. It's that the way in which information technology, all sorts of different sociological factors have now influenced politics, I think its main feature is bureaucracy. But the bureaucracy is not intrinsic to the system, I don't think.
Yeah.
I think it's something to do with all sorts of various economic, cultural, technological advancements as you know, in quotation marks, advancements.
Yeah, and I think he would agree, and then maybe the difference is he then sees. I think that you can't have what he describes as faithful presence without challenging what you're describing. Yes,
and that's probably where you and I would disagree. I think non-participation becomes one of the greatest acts of, it actually becomes a political act in the sense of an Aristotelian act, as in action in the public sphere, non-refusal to participate in bureaucracy as much as possible.
I exist in a university in which I attempt to refuse bureaucracy all the time. Yeah. So I'm not against that. My point is that it's not sustainable to just engage in just a negative refusal. Mm. You actually have to engage in something, a positive project as well, because I think these things will overrun you. So
I guess I am Batman, aren't I?
Yeah, yeah. We've described this before. I'm Superman, you're Batman. You're like, you know, you'll just cut people down and so on. And I try and say, yeah, let's have a go. so
come on, everyone.
Come on, get your shit together. Let's just, you know, take down Lex Luthor. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
So the second point I just want to add to this, and then go back to wrap around to my point about I don't think you can have faithful presence without something of a deeper political theology, for example. But the second point that I think is crucial to add to his, so that you get a fuller picture of what he's arguing, is he frames this in terms of sort of hyper-pluralism. Mm. Now, this is an argument that is echoed, I don't know whether I think they are friends and so on, so maybe they are consciously echoing each other. Both, again, neo-Calvinist sort of thinking is from Nicholas Waltersdorf, right? Nicholas Waltersdorf argues that you can't have the virtue-oriented polity, you know, the king who would cultivate virtue and work towards the virtue of the citizenry and so on, you know, some shared conception of the commonweal, right? You can't have that, Waltersdorf and Hunter argued, in a context of pluralism. Hunter goes even as far as to say, you know, the West was never Christian, you know, and this kind of, which is a bit strange.
Who goes for it?
Hunter does. Right. And actually, so does Waltersdorf in his Mighty and the Almighty. He says Christianity shattered the unity of any geographic space because it brings to bear something else, some other authority that then is in contrast to pagan, and then the paganism splits off into various things, and there's just pluralism all the way down, sort of thing, right? So there's two elements to this, right? One is
these Christian realists that are like, is Waltersdorf a theological realist?
Or is he a
socialist? Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah.
Plus, it's very.
It's what?
That's incorrect. Plus, it's just assuming that there's nothing ontologically grounding the unity of the church. So, yeah.
Ah, yeah. Well, see, there's also a Protestant flavor to this, right? Mm. So it's fractured in part because you've got multiple churches.
Yeah.
So you can't talk about the church and state anymore. You talk about spheres as they do here, right? Faithful presence. Yes, he talks about the church as a polis, but he's much more interested in talking about, you know, how we as networks of individuals sort of congregate in different places and so on. So there's a very Protestant flavor to this, right? But so the hyper-pluralistic, now that has two elements to it. One is to say that the world is post-secular. So there's a kind of element of saying you can't just take for granted sort of, you know, a rationalist narrative as governing all life.
Yep.
Everyone's trying to do their thing in public life in different religious ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it also points to, again, you can't have, as I said, you can't have a state or a civil authority that is trying to work towards what Augustine would call, you know, the res publica, right? The common good, the common orientation of love and so on, the virtuous citizenry, the that, you know, binds us together in some sort of common project of, say, solidarity or fraternity or ultimately charity, as I wrap it on about all the time, right? Because you have this fracturing of society in pluralistic ways in which makes it that, which then supports the idea that if you were to try and instantiate or try to shape the logic of the exercise of political authority, then you would be engaging in that boogeyman of Constantinianism.
Yeah, right. So it's the idea that
which is not a boogeyman, because Constantinianism is fine.
So it's this idea that liberalism seeks to substitute law with, rather, tries to substitute culture with law.
Right.
So rather than having a culture that will bind the people together and shape the affections and so forth, just coercive state power.
So law is necessary in this context because you have that, right? Yes. Because you have that fracturing.
But this is where, you know, this is my problem with people who kind of reduce politics or the coercive state power of the state to just law in a pluralist society.
Right.
You end up creating, like, you tell this mythology that we are fundamentally in conflict with one another, and then we create this Leviathan to create that war.
Right.
So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yep. And we must then mediate our relations through contracts.
Yep.
Or, you know, we create a discourse of rights in which we have the bond between us as a sense of mutual protection against infringements of the other person.
And because the state has no conception of what human flourishing looks like, it dehumanizes us. It doesn't view us as persons because we need a culture to tell us what being human involves. And so we have a state that doesn't look at us on us as anything other than fluctuations of statistics or wills that can contract and things like that.
So then that just to take that point you're just making, right? So his idea would be, he may say something like, yeah, that's you're capturing something that's there, and that's why we.
I'm saying he's generating that reality.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. So then he would say we must go and do faithful presence instead. But I think there's a problem. So faithful presence again is this idea that you engage in sort of cultural formation with other Christians as a network of believers and so on, in which, you know, you become like the really outstanding, and you're, to allude back to what you were saying before, the outstanding comedian, right? Who then takes over the ABC, I guess, or something like this, right? Who knows? Or you form a commercial enterprise that is practicing more mutualism, right, between you and your workers, that is focused on the creativity of the good that serves a community, that pays fair wages, things like this, right? That's all good, right? That's all, that to me is, you know,
yeah, sure,
very much echoes a lot of the associationalist, a lot of the social pluralist thinking that you get echoed in things we've said before, I've argued before, right? But like, I think there's a problem if you leave the politics alone.
All those are economic, right? So they're alternate economic structures.
And sometimes they actually would demand or require legal frameworks.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, because current legal frameworks don't actually necessarily allow for some of the things that you're saying, right?
Yeah.
But there's also an argument to say, well, if it's good, then maybe it's not a bad thing to actually at times and judiciously use law as a means of encouraging that, right?
Yeah.
Or encouraging.
So, but that's where our social welfare system comes from, right? It's the state recognizing and appropriating things that the church was doing or other organizations of solidarity and things like that. So they become institutionalized in the state because the state recognizes them as a social good. And why not do that with any number of other forms of association? I mean, ideally what the state would be doing would be supporting.
Yes, nourishing.
Nourishing other forms of non-state-based association and affiliation.
But that's not
promoting some social good, but the state needs some sort of conception of what the good is.
And that's exercising authority.
So be able to recognize it.
But that's also exercising authority. It's exercising potentially law. It's certainly at times using the public purse, right, to provide both funding and support, right, for various neighborhood initiatives and all these various things. Now, so at that point, I think what's he actually saying? You know, he's not so faithful presence ultimately is quite thin political theory. Now, there's a good sense of that in that you don't want to over-theorize how Christians should be acting, right?
Yep.
Precisely for the point you've made on a couple of occasions, right? You shouldn't try and theorize when what you're dealing with is the work of God. And
that's right, yeah.
Entirely, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know.
And you're trying to emulate.
Yeah, and you get the sense for him that actually what he's probably suggesting is that a lot of this should be a matter of just simply private enterprise. So there's a point in his book, and I think it's a really interesting point, where he provides a table in which he talks about patronage and how the massive funds like Gates and various other MacArthur funds and all these various things, how much they throw money and so on at sort of humanities and various projects and so on in order to support endeavors of arts and things like this. And then contrast that with what Christians throw at, you know, what where their money goes and so on, and how basically we don't have a culture, he's saying, and this is again the American context, of patronage.
Okay.
In which there should be, you know, like those monastics I mentioned last week who went out into the communities but also, you know, joined up with the nobility in order to form networks of patronage to support the work that was going on and so on. So the sense is that I think he's kind of, he's interested in that sort of thing, right? As opposed to my argument would be that, well, the Christian task maybe in part, that's fine, but in part the Christian task should be, how do we consider politics and law in this way of pursuing a high ends of peace, love, justice, right relationships and so on, and that it's not simply, you know, violence, coercion, tools for the resentful.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time. Hopefully I didn't sound too negative about this work. This is a lot of what I've been saying is me trying to kind of grapple with these ideas deeply. I thoroughly recommend giving it a look.
No, no, it's really interesting and stimulating. And I think, as I said last week, I think we'll come back to this because at some stage we're going to, I think, maybe bite off some of this culture wars talk.
Thanks so much for joining us. Please like us and follow us on Facebook. You can just search for us there, for the UCatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter, at UCAT, that's EUCAT underscore podcast. And please drop us a review wherever you listen to us, and share us around as well. That really helps us to get more engagement. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week. Well, you'll hear from us next week as we talk about consumerism. See you then.